From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the second edition of the Bletchley Park podcast. This month we'll bring you highlights of the Enigma reunion, when around 60 veterans gathered to celebrate their achievements and commemorate those who can no longer come. But first, a quick look ahead at some upcoming events. The Winter Lecture Series starts on the 11th of October with a talk by Jeffrey Greaves on Bricksmith, a small reciprocal spying operation in Berlin, which followed World War II straight into the Cold War. And on Sunday the 14th of October, the number one best-selling author and trustee Michael Smith will host Mythbusters in the Mansion with the GCHQ historian and former GCHQ director Sir Arthur Bonsall. They'll examine questions such as, did Churchill let the Luftwaffe bomb Coventry? And did the Codebreakers use computers to break Enigma? You may have noticed Bletchley Park has been featured in an ITV1 drama. The beginning of the Bletchley Circle was set and filmed in Hut 11, the bomb room. The story is based on a fictional group of female Codebreakers who get back together in 1952 and solve a string of murders.
We used to make a difference every day. We saved lives, we fought.
That was the war. This is different.
Perhaps we could treat the killings like a code. Keep at it till we break it.
Gap in the pattern. You missed one.
Susan, if this pattern of yours was easy to find, then you'd have found it by now.
You really think that just by listening to the wireless, you can tell the police where to look for a murder victim?
The railways. That's how he's finding them.
If the killer is a railway guard or ticket inspector, then his schedule connected to her journey somewhere.
He's invisible.
First things first, need to find Mary Lawrence.
This girl you think we've missed. How do we find her?
He's working to a timetable. Look at the other variable location.
I'm sorry, Mrs. Gray. My men searched the area. There's nothing there. Nothing at all.
If we get ahead of him, we can stop him before he kills again.
Mercy.
Anyone can make a mistake, Susan.
Every year, the Enigma reunion is held to coincide with the anniversary of the arrival of the first Codebreakers at Bletchley Park. They'd received the coded message, Auntie Flo is not so well, indicating they should report for top secret duties. The day started with a presentation to the veterans by the CEO of the Bletchley Park Trust, Ian Standen.
I'm Ian Standen, for you folks, I guess, the new CEO. I've been here in post for 7 months, took over from Simon Greenish, who I'm sure you all remember well, who did such a good job in the 7 years he was in post here in taking Bletchley Park from where it was when he took over, which was a bit of a basket case, struggling to make ends meet, to something that, when he handed over to me, was a going concern and really thriving. I'm going to talk to you this morning a bit about where we are now, what we're actually doing at the moment, where we're going for the next couple of years, and then beyond that, what our long-term vision is for the future. And of course, at the end of that, I'm happy to take any questions you may have. I spent 25 years in the army prior to doing this job here. For me, it was a perfect job to come and pursue my hobby, which was military history and history in general, but also to keep the connection I had with the military. For much of my military career, I did the modern-day equivalent of what the Y services were doing during the Second World War. And indeed, my last job in the army was commanding that organisation. So to come and work in this environment was a real privilege for me. So first of all, look at where we are. 2011, fantastic year. 140,000 visitors, 120,000 of those through the gate on normal visits, about another 12,000 through a number of events. And very importantly, about 8,000 through our education programmes, outreaching to universities, schools and primary schools, which is really, really important stuff for us, because that is where the interest for the future lies. It's very important that what we have here at Bletchley Park tells current and future generations the importance of what went on in here in terms of its contribution to the war and the intelligence effort, and also in terms of its key position in the birth of computing. So all our work going forward is built around making sure that future generations understand that. 2012, from January to July this year, we're 30% up on those figures from last year, which is absolutely fantastic. So we're forecasting perhaps 170,000 visitors by the end of the year, which is great. So we're about to launch out on this project to start, and I say start, the restoration, because this project only really scratches the surface. There's so much to be done here, but certainly start that process of restoration.
My friend and I, we met today, and we worked together in 1943. Now, we were outstationed.
Which outstation were you at?
Chicksands Priory in Bedfordshire. Both of us were. You hear very little about us.
Absolutely. And that's why Sinclair, he's done his book on the wide services to start to increase the story. And as we go forward, of course, yeah, we try and tell the whole story. As part of the overview exhibition, we're going to tell the story end to end. But it'll only be an overview. And as we move forward, and we've got more resource and more space, we'll start to tell more of the detailed bits on that.
No, that's rather nice, isn't it, to think that we are going to be recognised.
But have you recorded your story so far?
No.
Well, please go and see Neil and speak to him for 10 minutes and, yeah, and he'll take it all down and then we've got it for the future.
Quite a bit, we couldn't talk about
it. You can now. Long past the 30 years, I'm afraid. A great testimony, I think, to the way you all kept your secrets while you were here. I've been delighted to talk to you, and if you want to have a chat to me personally, I'll be floating around in and around the area for the rest of the day. Enjoy the rest of your time here.
Thank you. Sinclair Mackay, the author of the hugely popular book The Secret Lives of Bletchley Park, gave a talk about the subject of his next book, The Listening Stations, or The Y Stations.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Recognition has been a very long time coming, not merely for all those brilliant veterans who worked within the bounds of Bletchley Park, but also for the thousands of veterans who were posted to the hundreds of Bletchley outstations all over the country and all over the world. These were people who, at all hours of day and night, were tuning in to ever-changing, elusive enemy frequencies, headphones on, inhabiting a curious half-world, and listening directly to the heart of the conflict. These were veterans who were intercepting the German Enigma codes, working flat out with diamond-sharp accuracy and quicksilver speed, and sending the communications on to Bletchley Park. Now, I have to confess, before I started researching The Secret Life of Bletchley Park back in 2009, I'd never heard of the Y Service. And during the course of working on that book, I still only had really, to be honest, the most superficial idea of it and of how crucial, really, it was to the entire Bletchley operation. All I knew is that it sounded suitably mysterious. What did the Y in Y Service stand for? What went on in all those hundreds of outstations? And who were the people who were sent to work at them? What I also didn't quite grasp was the sheer scale of the operation. Where did Bletchley Park get all its raw material from? All those countless Enigma-coded messages sent out in Morse from all corners of the German and Axis military machine in all the corners of the world. Who were the women and the men who sat down day and deepest night and plucked these impossibly scrambled messages from the air? I was aware of Chatham Ford and of the way that senior codebreaker Gordon Welshman forged very good links with the operatives there so that the transmission of material to Bletchley was incredibly fast, smooth and efficient. But Chatham was just one base. The south coast of England was dotted with listening stations. And not just England. There were stations to be found in Egypt, Murmansk, Ceylon, Singapore. There were converted schoolhouses in Africa and in India, which were home to multitudes of dedicated operatives, all working at high intensity to relay vital signals back to the code-breaking centre. Several years ago, the book that I was writing about Bletchley Park was primarily social history. I wanted to find out and convey what it had been like to live and work on a day-to-day basis in and around such an astonishing institution, and indeed the way that this experience went on to shape so many lives after the war. That book gave me the opportunity, and indeed the great privilege, to meet and talk to distinguished Bletchley veterans. Well, I'm now delighted to say that thanks to the Y Service, I have now had the chance to meet a great many more distinguished veterans, and to hear so many more amazing stories. Y Service operatives generally had to be very bright and very fast, They tended to be young because at that age, the brain was much more adaptable and flexible. It needed to be when faced with the prospect of hearing and transcribing Morse in one ear, listening to other radio traffic with the other. More often than not, deep into the night, all regular sleep patterns completely shot out of the window. Like the veterans of Bletchley Park, fitting public acknowledgement of the vital work of the Y Service has been a very long time coming, and for many, a great deal too late. In 2009, veterans received a commemorative medal, together with a letter from the then Prime Minister Gordon Brown. While the story of Bletchley Park is one of extraordinary ingenuity in the face of implacable and seeming mathematical impossibilities, the story of the Y Service is about this, but also about furious dedication, great technical skill, brilliant accuracy, and, above all, superhuman patience and endurance. As one veteran has remarked, their work could only start when the enemy himself had started work. And then they were required to perform at dazzling speeds with minds concentrated like laser beams. As some other veterans have pointed out, this was not a job for older people. Even those in their mid-30s were liable to burn out swiftly under the weight of the pressure. But for eager teenagers and young people in their 20s, the brain was still supple enough to cope. And after their arduous shifts, they were equally good at seeking out the fun and the laughter that would shake all that weight off. So this is not quite the story of the course of the war being changed by one single factor, not directly at least. But were it not for the amazing technical efforts, the special liaison units, all the stations, all those encoded messages relayed with such care, then the codebreakers of Bletchley Park would have had very little to go on. All the boffins, all the brave young wrens sailing out into dangerous oceans, plus the intrepid radio-carrying agents out in the field, hurrying from border to border in an effort to stay ahead of the enemy. This is to say nothing of all those thousands of preternaturally focused young women, some permanently damaging their hearing for the sake of doing their duty. Their efforts combined helped to make all the revolutionary leaps of Bletchley Park possible. Thank you. Yes. Thank you.
Any two lines. Left. Turn. Hold. General salute. Present. Arms.
That's how he broke the Lorraines, was on squared paper.
Yeah, but that was before Colossus, wasn't it?
It was before Colossus.
Obviously, if you did something which you then had to take to the lady at the end of the room...
Yeah, you know, if something clicked, I don't know, I can't remember.
Yeah,
it was a leading wren.
It was part of the process.
At the end, and they kept it. I've often thought, what was I doing afterwards? Oh,
and
it
might sort of, you know, spark some memories.
Yes, yes. Well, they had to give me something to do to keep me off the streets.
Well, of course, you could have been doing noughts and crosses, of course.
Exactly what I said. It could have been, quite easily. Anyway, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So her job was to set the tapes up, and her job was to mend the tapes if they broke. One morning she woke up and her eyes were badly swollen, so she ended up in hospital for about 3 weeks. And when she came out, they wouldn't allow her to go back onto operating the machine. So she was given another job, and that was what we were just trying to work out down there. We've worked out with Phil's help. She said she could remember pieces of squared printed paper. And Phil says she was almost certainly in the test tree because she believes that she worked in Block F, not Block H. And she was involved somehow or another in the manual processes that they did either side of the work that they did here on Colossus.
Your hair printed money 1922. You let other women make up for you. Why don't you do right?
The great joy of the Enigma reunion is the opportunity to meet and talk to the veterans themselves. And some of the greatest stories don't come as answers to questions like, which section did you work in? Mimi Galilee was just 14 when she started working at Bletchley Park as a messenger. She insists her job was very lowly, but she was party to most secret information. Her memories of the park aren't quite as visual as most people's, and gave us a whole new perspective.
Can you just tell me how you first came here?
Yes, my mother knew Captain Bradshaw, and I think my mother must have been talking to him about me, because he said, bring her up, because I wasn't learning anything at school. I was in a temporary hut as a school in Bletchley, because we evacuated here. And he asked me one or two questions. What were my hobbies and did I enjoy reading? And I must have answered the right questions for him. I was interviewed in here in the house, in one of the corridors near the kitchen.
When you come in here now, does it take you right back to that time?
I know the feel of the ground. This is from being a messenger, because I tramped for 2 years with all the messages around the park, and I knew where the soft parts were and the more difficult parts, and I knew exactly how the ground felt. I can still feel it when I come in. I have taken people over the house, because being a messenger, you had to know where everybody was, because you had to take things everywhere. All of the important parts had names to them, you see. We used to have at least 4 or 5 deliveries that we had to make a day. And my department, when I was so young, used to close at about 6 o'clock, I think, because I wasn't allowed to work beyond certain hours because of my age.
So you were the baby of the park, really?
Well, one of them. I think there were about 5 of us. And most of them, I think, were probably older than me.
Like most people who worked here, you only knew about your little bit and most people didn't have the bigger picture for security reasons. But it has made piecing together the history all the more difficult, of course. But by coming to the reunion events and talking to other veterans, you must have learned a lot about what else was going on.
I don't remember ever knowing that they were doing code breaking here. I never knew that. I used to see the papers with the figures and letters on them, but it didn't mean a thing to me. I wasn't interested. I was a child.
Do you remember when you learned how important what had happened here was?
Well, I just knew. You see, I must have signed the Official Secrets Act at least 4 times. And even then, we were told that for 30 years, you had to remain silent. And when Hugh Lungi, on my interview for Bush House, when he saw I'd worked at Bletchley, asked me, what was I doing, you know, I just said, I'm sorry, I can't discuss that. I'm under the Official Secrets Act. And I didn't know then that he knew a lot about it. Not only that, and I didn't know this. And I only know it now because he became head of my department in Bush House. He was one of the few interpreters at the Anglo-Russian talks with Stalin. I've seen him a lot on film since the end of the war. I didn't know what he was when he interviewed me. Nothing was said. And then until such time as the act was lifted, must have been about 1975 or so, I still didn't know that it had something to do with us before the war. My mother and my older sister worked here as well, and my sister worked in Hut 10 for Josh Cooper, and I never, ever knew what she did. And I had to go over there sometimes with messages. But, of course, we didn't speak in the office until the day I turned up for work in her clothes because I felt I had nothing decent to wear at home. I put on a new blouse and skirt of hers, never thinking I would be sent to Hut 10 to deliver a message to one of the WAF officers there. I walked into the room. My sister was sitting there. I crept past her desk and I just handed her what I had to give her, turned round, and as I walked, I had to pass my sister's desk. As I walked past, I saw her eyes more than her head turn and say, "You wait until I get you home." And I didn't know what to do. And I'd split her blouse here on the seat.
And did you get it when you got home?
Well, there was a big row. My mother said, "You're not going to touch her," you know. And that's how secretive everything was. I was an embarrassment to her here anyway. And she said, "I don't ever tell anybody you're my sister." She was ashamed. But when I was put upstairs, I had no idea that it was such an important department until I was working in it. Everything was plain language. But I still don't remember seeing anything uncoded, I mean. Not that we worked on codes in there, as far as I know. But for all I know, we might have done. I didn't. But I was taught to type when I was in that office. and was able to take a job as a typist after I left Eastcote.
Well, it's a privilege to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for asking me.
Don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
The day was rounded off with a memorial service by the Bletchley Park chaplain, Chris Hicken, which ended with a poem specially written and performed for the veterans by the Milton Keynes Poet Laureate, Mark Neal.
This is also Alan Turing's centennial year, and it's interesting to note the local paper actually ran something on Turing's athletic ability in long-distance running. Interesting to note that the times he actually performed on his runs were good enough to put him actually into the medal positions in the current Olympics. This country quite rightly owes him a debt of gratitude. The Veterans Memorial, graciously dedicated by Her Majesty, and the medals that have been issued are a very tangible expression of thanks from a grateful nation to you and to those with whom you served. And today we meet to remember them. For some of you, active service overseas meant that you were in constant danger of being discovered, and in some cases people paid with it for their lives. They died to protect what they held dear to their hearts, which was their country. The Bible tells us that there is no greater love than that a man will lay down his life for his friends. Although the war is long over, memories are still fresh. Even today, there is a reluctance to tell in detail what you did during those years. Your dedication and commitment to the present and upcoming generations. I only hope that we can learn from you to give the same to our country. Winston Churchill, when praising the efforts of the Royal and Commonwealth Air Forces, said the now immortal words that never in the field of human conflict has so much been owed by so many to so few. And I believe those sentiments also quite rightly belong to you as well. We owe you all a debt of gratitude for what you did for this country during the war. They shall grow not old, as we who are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun, and in the morning, we will remember them.
We will remember them.
This poem is called Quercus Alba. It was a simple grave, garlanded with two lengths of splintered oak we hoped would speak of England. This Tommy, actually called Tommy, would no longer joke when scared witless by another whistle of airborne death. "You're the one they're firing at," we said to keep him sane. Well, now they got him. Perhaps we could all pack our bloody bags. Anointed with foreign soil, tears and sweat, we couldn't bring ourselves to pray, and the king could save himself today. We split his rations, found the letters we promised to post that would bittersweet Christmas and those to come. We drew straws for his hip flask, then all took a nip. We didn't mourn his passing, but the life he'd never have. We pledged to see his mother and speak well of him. It seemed a fitting penance for getting out alive. It was just me in the end, tea in the best china, one Sunday in that saddest spring. I wept and couldn't find the words to tell her. It was because her table was made of oak.
You've been sequestered in a corner of the mansion today, asking people about their recollections of any poetry about or inspired by the park. How did you come by that idea?
Well, I came here about a month ago as part of an exchange project between Bletchley Park and MK Museum. So I spent a day up at MK Museum and then one here, and we were writing various postcards and sending them from the post offices there. And I met a lady who told me, because I was a poet, said, "Oh, did you know they wrote poetry here during the war?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, I've got a couple of poems," and she sent me a couple, one of which I think might have been more of a review piece, a comic monologue called An A to Z of Bletchley Park. So I was very interested in that, and I'm hoping that this could make the basis for a really, really great project to gather together poems that were written by, at, and about Bletchley Park, because whilst they were fighting a war, they still had a social life. Many of the people who worked here were academics. They would have written poetry as well. So I think that could make the basis of a lovely anthology. This has been the start of doing some research into that.
I think people generally wrote poetry more at that time.
Yes, I think at that time it was very much more common that people did write poetry as an outlet. Poetry is such a broad church these days, you know, from things like comic monologues, little witty ditties. In fact, in her tape, there is a poem written by BT Engineer saying, "Don't forget the part that we played," in there as well. So, yes, I think it doesn't have to be the very elite, high-end academic sort of stuff. It can be everyday vernacular, but just used in a very beautiful way.
And how have you got on gathering people's memories today?
Well, it's been very interesting. I haven't had that many people come and chat to me, but those who have been priceless, really. Talking to one chap who said, "I'm really interested in the project," said, "I didn't write any poetry." But then he said, "Oh, but I did used to do a double act in cabaret with a girl who used to be a model." And his wife said, "I beg your pardon." "Oh, she was beautiful, she was." So secrets are still being unveiled today. And just had a conversation with someone whose friend is the daughter of a veteran and said she wrote poetry and they sent a lot of them to the British Museum.
It's somewhere out there to be unearthed, isn't it?
I'm sure once we start looking, there'll be lots to uncover.
And it's not just the historic poetry that you're interested in. You actually want to be inspired, don't you, and to take it forward and write some now.
Yes, I feel that there's a fantastic well of inspiration about the jobs that some of the people did. What I love about poetry, it can say so much in so few words. It can be very evocative. And so that's what I'd love to do, is maybe put some of the histories of the veterans and put them into poems, and maybe even record some of them with some of the sounds going on in the background that they would have heard at the time, because there's a lovely rhythm to some of the machines when they get going that I think will just help the metre and the flow of the poetry.
I hope your day here has inspired you.
I found it very moving, and a bit at the end with the service when I had the honour of reading a poem about the war to the veterans, I did find very moving. I've had some people stop me and say how much they appreciated the poem, so that's been very lovely.
Well, thank you for being part of it, and I hope it bears fruit.
Thank you.
Thank you to the staff, volunteers, visitors and veterans of Bletchley Park who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk or find us on iTunes. You can also follow us on Twitter, where we are at @BParkPodcast, and join our Facebook group. A big thank you must go to Audioboo, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. Thanks for listening. We'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.